From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. I was a devoted fan of HBO's Boardwalk Empire. The series followed the rise of organized crime in America during Prohibition. It was prestige television at its best. Historic details and characters, real and imagined, felt just right. So I noticed when a member of a secretive task force closing in on the New York mob was depicted on the show as an African-American woman.
Maybe I shouldn't ask.
That'd be a good idea.
Well, get cleaned up. Hodge is on his way and he's loaded for bear.
What's going on?
Perhaps did you even see daylight? Salvatore Maranzano was murdered this afternoon in his office.
A black woman in the 1930s. Really? Yes, really. Eunice Hunton Carter was critical in building a case against the elusive gangster known as Lucky Luciano. Stephen Carter is a best-selling novelist, a columnist, and Eunice Carter's grandson. He joins us now from Yale University, where he is also a law professor, to talk about his new book, Invisible, The Forgotten Story of the Black Woman Lawyer Who Took Down America's Most Powerful Mobster. Stephen Carter, welcome.
Thank you, Virginia. It's a real pleasure. Thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
Well, I was such a devotee of Boardwalk Empire that I looked up that character, and I saw that I was not alone in thinking it was a bit of PC revisionism. What was the response that you saw?
So it's interesting. Yes, when Boardwalk Empire had the character, whose name, by the way, was Beatrice, she wasn't called that in the show, but it was in the credits, a lot of the fan pages insisted this was impossible. It had to be some sort of Hollywood PC gone wild because there weren't any black women lawyers in the 1930s and there certainly weren't any prosecutors. But the fans were wrong. My grandmother, Eunice Hunton Carter, was a prosecutor in the 1930s. She did work for Thomas Dewey's 20 Against the Underworld, the team that was supposed to take down the mob. It was 19 white males and her. And I later had the good fortune to have lunch with the creator of Boardwalk Empire, who told me that that character was indeed based on my grandmother.
Wow. What did you know about your grandmother's role as a prosecutor when you were growing up?
So my grandmother died when I was in high school. And what I knew of her when I was a kid was basically that she was this tough and intimidating woman who was always criticizing which fork we picked up at dinner first or our grammar and so on. I knew absolutely nothing about her role as a prosecutor. I don't think I ever knew that she was a lawyer. After she died, I began to hear the family stories. My father and my mother both began to talk about it more, and I was fascinated. I learned more and more as the years went by and finally just had to take the time, and it took several years of research to tell her story because it just fascinated me more and more. It wouldn't let me go.
Well, part of the point that you make in this book is that many African-American families don't know their histories. In fact, you quote the historian Jonathan Holloway saying, "psychologically enduring the editor's pencil when looking at history." Why is that?
It really is true. A lot of African-American families, we don't know our history in part because our own parents or grandparents haven't told us. And I think one reason they don't is because a lot of the history that to us seems so inspiring is history that they lived and was often brutal and painful, and they don't see any need to burden their children with it. But that fact that we don't always know our history can make discovery that much more exciting. And one of the real joys of working on this project, and I worked on it with my daughter, Leah, who was my principal researcher. She's also a lawyer. One of the real joys of it was discovering what a rich and remarkable life my grandmother led. All these stories I didn't know, all these stories about her being a prosecutor, these stories about her being involved in the founding of the United Nations, these stories about her talking about the rights of women in the workplace and what we now call sexual harassment. She was talking about that back in the 1930s. All these things I had no idea of. It was exciting to learn them, and I came to understand that this woman who had scared me so was really just displaying the fortitude and determination that she needed to succeed back in that era.
What did you call her?
I called her Nana. We all did. There were five kids that my father and mother had. We called her Nana, although since we had two Nanas, one who lived in New York, that was Eunice, and the other lived in New Rochelle, we actually called her Nana in New York. And when I was very little, I thought that was her name.
Well, it wasn't only your Nana, but her entire family, your parents, Eunice's parents, her brother, all led these impactful, extremely public lives. And I definitely want to get to her role in closing in on Luciano. But first, what was that like for you? You've written several novels, nonfiction books as well. What was it like to pick up your own history?
It was inspiring and it was moving. It was quite powerful to learn all these things that I didn't know. So to go back a couple of generations, for example, so Eunice's grandfather, that would be my great-great-grandfather, was enslaved in Fauquier County, Virginia. He escaped three times and was captured three times. He finally bought his freedom and moved to Canada, where he became a big activist in a number of what we now think of as civil rights causes. I knew none of that history. Eunice's father, William, basically founded what was known at the time as the Colored YMCA. The YMCA was segregated in those days, had branches all over the world, and he traveled all over the world in the service of this job, that he basically ran that part of the YMCA, that Eunice's mother, Addie, was a big activist who, among other things, went to Europe with the black troops in World War I and wrote a best-selling book about what she saw there, how badly the troops were treated, but also about their heroism in battle, and who also worked for the NAACP, which sent her into Badlands. She would travel around the country by herself, this little woman, going into communities that the Klan had, places where the Klan had so intimidated the black community that there was no activism going on, and she would be the one to be sent there to rouse them, to get the activism going again. These were Eunice's parents. I knew nothing of any of this until long, long after Eunice had died.
So for this book, you go back to Eunice's early years, your great-grandparents, William and Addie Hunton. They moved to Atlanta. This was in 1899. Give us a picture of thriving black Atlanta neighborhood around the Fourth Ward. What was that like?
So in the Fourth Ward of Atlanta, you had this remarkable community of black people, working class and middle class, who had built in the center of this segregated and often racially violent city a community where they could raise their children, and they had businesses, they had banks and insurance companies and real estate and restaurants. They had a drugstore that advertised that it had the most expensive soda fountain anywhere in the South, and that was a black-owned business and so on and so on. There were a lot of the people in the community were educators. Many of them were connected with the universities or taught at one of the three black public schools in Atlanta at the time. It was a community full of dynamism where people really believed they had something going on. It was a false peace. It was shattered in 1906. When a riot broke out that began with white people burning black businesses. There was a sense of jealousy and envy. In those days, Lower Peachtree was where many of these great black businesses were located, and the mobs started burning there and eventually moved into the neighborhoods where they began to attack black people in their homes. But the black people of the community had wisely armed themselves and fired at the mob, driving them off, at least temporarily.
You make the point that it was not people they were after, but the main target was property. What was going on in the dynamic and that quest for property?
So there was something of an economic crisis, of course, in many parts of the South around that time. And a lot of white Atlantans, particularly a lot of working class and poor people, became persuaded that the reason that their lives were so terrible was that black people were taking their jobs and taking their businesses and so on and so on. And a lot of the black businesses in Atlanta survived mainly on white customers as opposed to black customers. So a lot of the whites became very, very bitter. It's not a new thing in history that when there's an economic crisis, people get bitter and they look for some outsider to blame. And that's really what sparked the riot.
We're speaking with Stephen Carter. His new book is about his grandmother, Eunice Hunton Carter. It's called Invisible. And part of the story is not just a revelation of his own history, but I'm wondering, Stephen Carter, did you know about this thriving black economic center in a southern city at that time?
I didn't know anything about it when I was growing up. When I was in college, as it happened, I did my senior research, my senior thesis, my honors thesis on Atlanta University at that time. And so I began to learn about the community then. That came as a great revelation to me. I spent a summer in Atlanta, actually a couple of summers, but one summer in particular I spent in Atlanta when I was in college working in the archives at Atlanta University, digging some of these papers out and learning about the community. That was a great revelation, and although that was a long time ago, I'm sort of on in years, I always wanted to come back to that material about Black Atlanta long ago to make some sense of it and set a story there. And happily, I was able to set a true story there instead of fiction.
One of the true aspects of this that I found surprising was that the city directory laid out for the would-be mobsters in that 1906 riot, some call it a massacre, which homes to attack, because the Black homes were marked in the directory with a C for colored.
That's exactly right. And that mattered because the truth is there were still a number of integrated neighborhoods. That is, there were some neighborhoods where there were Black and white houses on the same block. My great-grandparents lived in such a house. That's where Eunice grew up when she lived in Atlanta. But yes, the mob would know who to attack because there was a little C next to the colored families, as they would have said then. And the evidence seems to suggest the mob paid attention because they were able, when they did go out into the Black neighborhood, they were able to attack the Black house and leave the white houses alone.
So this sent the Hunton family packing. They moved on to Brooklyn. Was this the defining event that made them leave Atlanta?
They loved Atlanta. They really had thought that they were going to stay. It was a city that they felt was vibrant and exciting. Eunice's mother, Addie, was from Virginia. She loved the South. But they just felt it was not an atmosphere in which they could raise children. At first, they thought they would move north temporarily because they knew William's work would still bring him back to the South. But they never went back. And one of the stories I learned working on this that I hadn't known was that when families began to move north in 1906 after the big Atlanta riot, Georgia and several other states sent people to try to persuade them to come back. They ran ads in the Black newspapers saying that, come on back, everything's fine, basically. I don't think it worked very much, but there was actually an effort to get people back because the white leaders of various communities realized that they were losing skilled workers, professionals, others who were part of the actual infrastructure of the city, and people they needed, but it didn't work. The violence that was directed at Black people made the North seem inviting. Obviously, the North wasn't perfect, but for a lot of families, it turned out to be safer.
That's Stephen Carter. He's a best-selling novelist, a columnist, and Eunice Carter's grandson. And we're learning about Eunice Carter. He's joining us from Yale University to talk about his book, Invisible, The Forgotten Story of the Black Woman Lawyer Who Took Down America's Most Powerful Mobster. Stay with us. We're going to talk about life in Brooklyn and beyond, the Harlem Renaissance, which Eunice was a part of, and of course, that case that she helped to crack. This is On Second Thought. This is On Second Thought from Georgia Public Broadcasting. I'm Virginia Prescott, and my guest is Stephen Carter. Maybe you know him as a Bloomberg opinion columnist. He's also an author of crime fiction books like The Emperor of Ocean Park and New England White. Well, his newest book is about real-life crimes and punishment. It is called Invisible, and the focus is his grandmother, Eunice Hunton Carter, who helped tighten the screws on the case against the very real-life criminal Salvatore Charlie Lucky Luciano, a cunning, cold-blooded gangster who's deeply embedded in American criminal history and imagination, been studied quite a bit, portrayed quite a bit, and the topic of biographies like this one from Biography.
Luciano thrived on his reputation as the biggest racketeer and the most eligible bachelor in Manhattan. But Lucky paid the price for his notoriety when a crusading gangbuster named Thomas E. Dewey sent him off to prison.
Stephen, you mentioned that your grandfather traveled the world as an international secretary for the YMCA. What did he actually do?
Eunice's father, William, was hired by the YMCA at a time when you have to picture the YMCA not as a proprietor of health clubs, say like today, but as an organization that had all these branches that aimed to raise young men with Christian values and so on. And William really believed in that work. William believed that the black community's future lay in raising virtuous young people who would then grow up to be virtuous adults. And he focused largely on the black colleges, although he had other focuses as well. And he literally went around founding chapters of the YMCA for black students, usually in places where there were already chapters that were segregated that only white students could go to. At the same time, he tried to work for integration within the YMCA, but that failed. The YMCA was not going to integrate. He also did travel the world. He gave a speech in Tokyo. He went to Switzerland. He had lunch at Buckingham Palace. He was a member of the leadership, effectively, of the YMCA, certainly the highest-ranking black person in the YMCA, and he gave his life for this work. When I say gave his life, I mean he got increasingly sickly, pushed himself too hard, and refused to rest. When he felt sick, he would take a few days off and go back on the road. And he died pretty young. He died when Eunice was in high school. Mainly, he'd essentially worked himself to death.
And her mother was also extremely busy and also prone to bouts of this exhaustion. What kind of attention did they have as children with these two parents who were traveling all over?
So there's a nice irony here that Addie Hunt and Eunice's mother first came to renown in the black community with a speech that she gave in Atlanta, in which she talked about how the duty of black men is to act better toward black women, and the duty of black women is to raise virtuous children for the race, that the speech was seen as a call for black women to stay home with their children, which was very funny because Addie herself did nothing of the kind. She was traveling around giving speeches a lot. And her speeches initially were speeches about virtue and so on, similar to the work that William is doing. But after William died in 1916, Addie really came into her own. That was when she went to Europe as one of only three black women who were sent to be essentially the social workers for all of the tens of thousands of black troops that were there. There were plenty of white women who had been sent as social workers, but they only worked with the white troops. The black troops were not allowed to work with them. The war was very segregated. So three black women were sent. She was one of them. She experienced the horrors of how badly the black soldiers were treated, but she also saw their heroism in battle and wrote a book about that when she came back that brought it to public attention. But during those 2 years, she wasn't raising the children. The children had guardians because she was off at war. So while their parents were these big activists and always talked about what they believed in the family, the truth is that the children were constantly being raised by neighbors, occasionally, if they could afford it, by a maid. It wasn't a matter of the parents spending the time to do what they were preaching that others should do, namely spend these enormous amounts of time with their children to raise them in this virtuous way.
Well, it's also interesting that Addie became increasingly drawn to the concept of Pan-Africanism, as was Eunice's brother named Alpheus, who was also a noted communist, devoted to the black cause and the messages, at least her parents, of industriousness and discipline and making it for their race. But Eunice seemed to be determined to beat those odds and find success in the white world. She went to Smith. She went to Fordham Law School, enrolled in Fordham Law School, even before the ABA was accepting African Americans. What do you think was going on? What was the draw for her?
So you're right that her parents were these big public activists, and her brother ended up being a public activist as well. Eunice got married after she went to Smith. She went to Smith, graduated in 1921, and got married 3 years later. And the marriage looks like it was in some sense dutiful. I think her mother expected her to get married, so she did. Her mother expected her to have a child. And so she did. And she moved to Harlem, where she lived with her husband, who was a dentist. And I think that the world of Harlem started to close in on her a little bit, that she had the opportunity to be one of the leaders of Harlem society, the people who decide who gets invited to which parties and so on, which is a big part of Harlem society for many, many decades. She was being groomed, in effect, for that work.
The women that you call the czarinas?
The czarinas. This was a term that was coined by, among others, Adam Clayton Powell, the czarinas who ran Harlem. And she was kind of a junior czarina. She was being raised to that. And I think that she looked around And she realized that was not the life that she wanted. She wasn't like her mother. She wasn't going to go out and be a public activist on every issue. In fact, she shied away from most issues at first. She thought of being a writer. She was involved early on in the Harlem Renaissance and published a lot. But I think in the end that there was a tug that said, I'm not going to simply live in an apartment in Harlem and go to parties. She wanted to be active in a different sense and decided she was going to be a lawyer. And you're right. This is a time when the bar was very segregated. The American Bar Association did not accept black members. And most of the major law schools did not accept women. Only a handful of them had black students at the time. So she went to Fordham, which was a Catholic school. A lot of the Catholic schools in the cities encouraged immigrants to attend, encouraged Jews and Catholics to attend, encouraged black people to attend, encouraged women to attend. They were serving a population that was not being served, and that was where she went to law school as a night student. She worked all day as a social worker and went to law school for 3 hours a night, 5 nights a week.
So her life looks, she looks like the toast of Harlem in some ways. Their lives were very well covered in the vibrant black newspapers operating across the country at the time, New York City, Baltimore, Philly, other places. You know, I read of stories of fancy weddings that they attended, she, her mother, brother, and news of their travels, illnesses, one scandalous marriage on the part of her mother. These newspapers must have been invaluable for you in tracking the lives of your ancestors.
It's such a rich resource, the black newspapers of the time. There were so many of them. They were so widely read, basically because white newspapers didn't cover what was going on in the black community. And so the big black newspapers, the Amsterdam News, the Pittsburgh Courier, these were not only read in, say, New York and Pittsburgh. These were mailed all over the country. There were families that get a stack of newspapers every week, and they would look at what black people and black families were accomplishing and doing. And yes, you're right, even such details as where people were traveling. So what's remarkable is then when one sits down to write a history of that period, we can draw a picture of the black community, at least a kind of picture, from looking at the stories, seeing what was being covered. And there's so much information on who was where, on what day, and what speech did they give, and so on. The newspapers of the time were an invaluable resource in understanding Eunice and what she was doing and what really the forces that had formed her.
And they're sort of newsy, but also sort of gossipy. Was that characteristic of the time or just the black newspapers?
That was true of a lot of newspapers. I think it was more true in the black community in a sense because the middle class was relatively small and a lot of these people knew each other. And so you would read about people you knew and so on, and then other people would read, find out what the black middle class people were doing as well. The truth is a lot of the newspapers, it wasn't quite news and it wasn't quite gossip. It was more of accounts of, say, meetings of big black sororities and fraternities and so on and so on. I should say it's not what we think of as news, but to people in the community it was extremely important.
Hmm. We're speaking with Stephen Carter about his remarkable family. He is joining us from Yale University, where he is also a law professor. And we're talking about his book, Invisible, The Forgotten Story of the Black Woman Lawyer Who Took Down America's Most Powerful Mobster. Well, the other part of the story here is that the same year that the Huntons arrived in Brooklyn, Antonio and Rosario Luciana arrived from Sicily with their son, Salvatore, who as an adult established the commission or the structure of mafia that really dominated the 20th century. How did he change the game and how did he come to be called Lucky?
Yeah, Lucky was nicknamed Charlie Lucky, as he was often called. It's a little unclear exactly why he was called Lucky. Some people say it's because he escaped so many attempts on his life. Others say it's because he had this wonderful habit of killing senior mobsters who were trying to kill him first.
That's one kind of luck.
That's one kind of luck. But what's clear is that his parents moved to Brooklyn, to Manhattan, I mean, in 1907, about the same time that Eunice's parents moved to Brooklyn. And actually, his family did live briefly in Brooklyn also. Then they moved to Manhattan, where he went to public school, and he fell in with a tough gang of kids. When he was young, he was arrested a couple of times. But slowly, it became clear that this is a fellow who had brains as well as brawn. He, at that time, New York had a number of different white ethnic mobs controlling different corners of the city. But he began to be respected by a lot of different mobs and slowly consolidated his power. And he really did establish the model of the mob, of the mafia, that people see in the movies and on television, read about in books. He established the Mafia Commission. He established the idea of these five co-equal families in New York. The idea of doing all this was to make sure that there would be peace so that the families could earn their money, and he, of course, could earn his without worrying about wars within the mob, whatever they might have to do outside in order to extend their territory. And he and Eunice obviously didn't know anything about each other, but in the early 1930s, the mob decided to move into Harlem. Harlem at the time was the most lucrative territory for the New York mob, in large part because so many people played the numbers. In fact, not only did some people play the numbers, which we can think of as the illegal lottery, but 10,000 or 20,000 Harlemites worked in the illegal numbers. So it was a very lucrative territory, heavily run by black gangs. In the early 1930s, the white gangs made war on the black gangs, took Harlem over. And by the time Eunice graduated law school in the early 1930s, the white mob ran Harlem.
He was well-respected. Why was he so elusive to the law, and what was his role in this numbers racket?
So what he was able to do that the gangsters before that hadn't done very often was to establish a lot of layers of insulation between himself and anyone who'd actually commit a crime, so that the way that he structured things, he and the people around him weren't going out and holding people up or corrupting politicians. What they did instead was they allowed people to operate various illegal businesses, loan sharking businesses, prostitution businesses, and so on. And they simply taxed those businesses. They took a bite of it. So their risk was very small because they were never out there on the street doing anything where they could be caught. And on the off chance that someone out there who knew what Luciano and the people around him were doing decided to turn state's evidence, there were often ways to make that person disappear.
The parallel lives or their parallel tracks in New York intersect after Eunice is hired as a prosecutor by Thomas Dewey. This is this famous commission that he puts together to capture or to crack down on organized crime. Why did the DA Dewey hire her?
So let me go back just one step. There were all these cries by municipal reformers by the mid-1930s demanding a special prosecutor for organized crime because the New York DA, who was a very corrupt man named William Dodge, wouldn't lift a finger to do anything about crime or organized crime, about the mob. And so finally, Thomas Dewey was appointed. He was a former federal prosecutor. He was a young man. He was actually a younger than Eunice. He was a year younger than Eunice. He was appointed as the special prosecutor. And he said he was going to hire a team that was absolutely clean with no connection to any of the corruption in the DA's office. And he hired 20 lawyers. They became known in the press immediately as 20 against the underworld. And the lawyers were 19 white men, young white men, and one young black woman. And that was Eunice. And when he announced his lawyers, newspapers from New York to California printed headlines, and the headlines didn't say Dewey announces his team. It said Dewey hires black woman lawyer. In fact, Eunice's picture appeared in newspapers, at least to the extent they could find her picture, because it was a kind of man bites dog story. Many years later in his memoir, Dewey explained her hiring in a way that's actually pretty simple. He said he wanted to have one woman on the team, and there was a judge he knew. He said, I know this brilliant black woman you need to talk to, and he had her come down to the office. And he hired her on the spot. That was the story that he told. And maybe it was as simple as that. Maybe it was really that she impressed him that much. Or there may be another reason. Eunice never said, but that was Dewey's explanation of what happened.
Stephen Carter is going to stick around. He's a best-selling novelist, a columnist, and Eunice Carter's grandson. He's also a law professor at Yale University. And his new book is called Invisible, The Forgotten Story of the Black Woman Lawyer Who Took Down America's Most Powerful Mobster. And as we head into the break, some music from the very year that Eunice Carter helped nab Lucky Luciano. This is Fats Waller. And this is On Second Thought.
alive. Millions of hearts have been broken, yes, yes.
Just because these words were spoken. You know the words that were spoken? Here it is. I love you, I love you, I love you, I love you.
We're back with On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott with Stephen Carter. He's author of Invisible, the forgotten story of the black woman lawyer who took down America's most powerful mobster. That woman, his grandmother, Eunice Hunton Carter, did key investigative work that helped finally capture and prosecute Charles Lucky Luciano. Well, Luciano's luck ran out in 1936. He was arrested in Hot Springs, Arkansas on a criminal warrant from New York. Prosecutor Thomas Dewey made a deal to deport him rather than to serve out his sentence. And that's all a matter of public record. But Eunice's really extraordinary life is not. She is a crucial hidden figure in American history.
It's funny you mention hidden figures. I think we live in an era when so many people in the black community, and frankly, so many women, including women of color, feel a sense of barriers, a sense of pressure, a sense of the fragility of accomplishment at this moment. And I think it's an era when people are yearning for stories about people who did accomplish, facing even greater barriers. I think that's one reason we're turning up all these stories now. It's a very important thing at this moment.
Well, it's also a time when true crime is fascinating to people. Maybe it's some sort of retreat from real life, but also something that's imaginable. And there's a story here of tremendous subterfuge where this unit, where the 20 Against the Underworld set up, they're right downtown in New York City or in Tribeca now, at the Woolworth Building, a highly secretive place. Give us a sense of that place.
So they were up on the 14th floor of the Woolworth Building. This is where Dewey made his headquarters. He had detectives in the lobby who were trained to recognize organized crime figures who might try to sneak in. All the windows were covered with frosted glass. Phone calls out were not permitted unless authorized in writing by one of the 20 lawyers. There were guards all over the place. There were hallways that only had one exit and one entrance because Dewey wanted to control who could get in and who could get out, because he thought the only way to avoid corruption was to have absolute control over what everyone was doing and to know who wasn't there at all times. And this is where Eunice and the other 19 young lawyers ended up. What's interesting is that most of the offices of the lawyers were along this one long hallway, which led to a foyer, and Dewey's office was on the other side of the foyer. Eunice, the one black woman in a unit of 19 white men, those are the other lawyers, had the furthest office away from Dewey's, all the way at the end of the hallway, this little cubicle, which I think symbolized, in a sense, this was a matter of race and gender in part, but it also symbolized the notion that maybe Dewey did hire her not so much initially for her legal expertise, but with the sense that she was going to be a sign of his commitment to what we would now call diversity. I don't think he had any idea when he hired her that of all those assistants, she would be the only one who came up with evidence of a prosecutable crime against Lucky Luciano.
So in her isolated existence at the end of the hallway, there she is. She is assigned to, among other things, track complaints that came in from citizens. And many of them came in and said, well, there's a house of prostitution. There's a brothel right down the street. And there are pimps and streetwalkers walking out through outside my door, which actually proved key. How did she figure out? How did she untangle this way to Luciano?
Dewey was determined that he was not going to try a prostitution case. He even said that publicly. There were two reasons. One is Dewey had political ambitions and he did not want to be thought of as an anti-vice crusader. That might cost him votes. But also because, like most experts at the time, he did not believe that prostitution was connected to the mob. He thought, yes, loan sharking was and all these other things, but not prostitution. The trouble was that when the office opened its doors and said, if you have a complaint, come on down and one of our lawyers will talk to you, citizen after citizen, as you said, came down to talk about prostitution in the neighborhoods. Someone had to handle that. It was all dumped on Eunice. There are all these memos in the files that you can find even now. Send this to Mrs. Carter, send that to Mrs. Carter, all these accounts of prostitution. Eunice would write these up. She would send them up the chain of command, and there was no response to any of them because Dewey did not want to try a prostitution case. The irony was that Eunice, by carefully collating all the different addresses where prostitution was known to take place, and also by actually interviewing the women who worked in this trade, which is something that hadn't been done before, by interviewing them, she was able to put together a picture of a system in which the women who worked in prostitution actually were paying protection money to the mob. No one else was able to do it. No one else had tried to do it. She was, and of course, that was the crime for which Lucky Luciano was finally tried and convicted. The only crime for which he was tried and convicted was the crime that Eunice had discovered, where Eunice put together the evidence of what had happened, put together the witnesses to prove it. It was really her case. And again, the irony of race and gender, it was her case, her evidence, her witnesses, and when the time came to try the case, Dewey selected three white men to try it with him, not Eunice.
So at the time, even though she was the key to the case, did anybody know outside of that little HQ, which was so tightly held, like a fortress?
Probably not at first. After the trial was over, Dewey, at his press conference, did thank her as one of the two or three assistants without whom this wouldn't have taken place. So it became public knowledge. It wasn't public knowledge at first. When it did become public knowledge in 1936 that she was really the one to put all this evidence together, it actually made her almost overnight one of the most famous black women in America. Suddenly, she was getting awards and getting honorary degrees and being profiled in Life magazine and other things, that she was suddenly this person everyone was talking about and interested in. The irony of that is she didn't even get to try the case. But her connection to the case alone was enough to create this aura around her. And she was a prosecutor for another decade. And during those 10 years, she really remained someone who was very well known across the country, much better known in the black community, of course, but very well known and often in the newspapers, the larger newspapers as well.
Dewey, of course, went on to run against Roosevelt and not defeat Truman, we should note, from the famous headline or premature headline, as a Republican. And Eunice was a lifelong Republican with tremendous loyalty to the party. Tell us about that shift, a 20th century shift from the party of Lincoln, the Republicans, which was the progressive party in many ways, to the Democratic Party, especially within the African-American community.
Yeah, politics were very complicated back then. Of course, in the early years after black people got the vote, they voted very heavily Republican. As you say, it was the party of Lincoln. Lincoln freed the slaves and so on. And that really continued up through about the 1930s when the party, when the Democrats finally began to make inroads. But Eunice stuck with the Republican Party, and there were a number of reasons for this. One of the reasons was that it was the Democrats who were the people who were courting the Solid South, meaning the segregationist South. It was the Democratic politicians who'd fomented the public anger that had led to the Atlanta riot. But it was also true, and it's easy to forget this, that in the 1930s and 40s, the Progressive Party and Civil Rights was the Republican Party. And in fact, in 1944, when Dewey ran against Roosevelt and lost badly, but when he ran on what was then the strongest civil rights plank that any major party in America had ever adopted in a campaign. And when he campaigned, he talked about the black people he appointed to prominent positions, including Eunice, whom he spoke of openly. He campaigned with black people, went to black events in large numbers, trying to get the black vote. And Eunice, incidentally, was also crucial in developing that 1944 platform plank that he ran on. Dewey, in a way, became Eunice's mentor. They were friends. She campaigned for him when he ran for district attorney. She campaigned for him when he ran for governor. She campaigned for him when he ran for president. She went out and worked very, very hard on his behalf. And when he campaigned, she was often, when he went to a black neighborhood or a black event, she would often be there at his side as evidence. You could look and see, this is a black woman whom I entrusted with all these various duties.
You refer to the black community throughout the book as the darker nation. What do you mean by that term?
So the Darker Nation is a term that I guess I invented for a novel years ago just because I had a character who I was trying to find something he could call Black America because he was quirky and I thought he might call it something different. But it's grown on me, this notion of the Darker Nation, because it implies both a kind of solidarity within the community and also makes a claim of a place within the larger nation. When I coined it, I was unaware. I learned later that, among others, Mary McLeod Bethune and W.E.B. Du Bois and Elaine Locke, to name just a few of the great Black intellectuals of the past, all of them used phrases that were nearly identical to this at one time or another. So maybe the other reason I used it is it connects me with a tradition in the Black community that's been largely lost about how we refer to ourselves.
We're talking with Stephen Carter, the author of the book Invisible. It's about his grandmother, the Black woman lawyer who helped take down Lucky Luciano, then America's most powerful mobster, and really getting a vision of 20th century history through her life and the changes in her life. And one of the things that became her cause was she became an international leader and had her eye on a sense of unification in the world through justice. She was great friends with Eleanor Roosevelt. You mentioned Mary McLeod Bethune, who was a great friend and intellectual leader of hers. How did this sense of, let's say, liberation for women precede? Do you think it did precede the women's movement, which was to come decades later?
Eunice was talking about issues of importance to women, particularly women in the workforce, long before it was fashionable and long before the days of the modern women's movement. In fact, back in the 1930s, for example, Eunice gave a speech in which she talked about women in the workplace, and she talked about men who took advantage of their positions to extract, as she said, relations of an intimate nature from the women who worked for them. And she said in the speech, boiling in oil is a little too good for that sort of men. That's what she said. Now, you have to imagine, she's saying this in the 1930s in the midst of the Depression when most people are just happy to have a job. But she's talking about it. This became a lifelong cause for her. It eventually mixed with the internationalism that became a part of her after she left the prosecutor's office, and she began to travel the world and get involved with a number of international organizations. She was involved in the founding of the UN, but she was on a number of international commissions involving the rights of women, and this became a cause with which she was closely associated really to the end of her life.
Her brother is a complicated character that we haven't talked that much about. William Alpheus Jr., known as Alpheus. He was also a Pan-Africanist, like his mother, but a communist or a member of the Communist Party, friends with Dashiell Hammett, Paul Robeson, among others who were known or thought to be communists. What was his track like compared to hers, which was working in this very legitimate, government-oriented job, compared to him, who was a known communist?
Yeah, it's an interesting distinction. So yes, you have Eunice, who is out there working as a prosecutor and is a Republican. And then you have her brother. Now, Alpheus was phenomenally well-educated. He was multilingual. He had degrees from Howard University and from Harvard University and from NYU. He was an expert in Victorian poetry. And he was a communist. And it's important to emphasize that he was a real communist. He wasn't someone who was, say, falsely accused of communism in the McCarthy era. He was a real communist. He was high ranking in the party. His FBI file is 700 pages long, much longer, for example, than, say, Martin Luther King's FBI file. Hmm. He was on the FBI's radar for a very long time. He genuinely believed that Black people could not be free under capitalism. He believed that communism was the only real alternative. When I say a communist, I don't mean he was a kind of casual Marxist. He was a Stalinist. He became a supporter of Stalin in a big way. And here's the effect on Eunice. Eunice, as I said, spent years working for Dewey, years working as a prosecutor, and years in service to the Republican Party. And she always thought that her reward for this would be some kind of high office, maybe a judgeship or something else. But she especially wanted to be a judge. None of that ever happened. And we look back at it now, we could say, well, race probably played a role. Well, gender probably played a role. Well, the combination of race and gender probably played a role. But Eunice always believed it was her brother. Mm. Because in those days, the 1940s and the early 1950s, you could not aspire to high office with a brother who, as I said, was not just, say, falsely accused of being a communist, was a genuine, dedicated member of the Communist Party. It simply was not going to happen. Eunice blamed him for it. And in 1951, when Alpheus went to prison for contempt of court for refusing to name names, Eunice, who at the time had left the prosecutor's office, now had her own legal practice, did not lift a finger to help him. By that time, the siblings were completely estranged from each other. She genuinely believed his views were harmful, but she also thought that his political views had harmed her career.
Your father is Eunice's son, Lyle Jr. Did he have a relationship with his uncle, Alpheus?
He did. My father spent a lot of time with his uncle Alpheus. When his uncle Alpheus was having legal problems, my father was just out of law school, and his mother absolutely forbade him to go and meet with or go visit even his uncle. And in later years, he regretted letting her talk him into leaving the case alone. So after Alpheus got out of prison at the end of 1951, my father actually spent a lot of time visiting him at his home in New York City and really enjoyed talking to him, even though he'd by no means agreed with him. But Alpheus's life was never the same after prison. And in spite of this phenomenal education and all of his many talents, he couldn't really get serious work. And he ultimately left the United States in the late 1950s and moved to Africa, first to Ghana and then to Zambia. He never returned to the United States. He died in 1970. As Eunice did, they died 10 days apart.
So, and tremendously heralded, successful in so many ways, woman. Do you think your Nana, stern as she was, disciplined as she was a happy person?
That's a hard question. I think that the joy for her came largely through accomplishment. You know, there are people who take joy in their families and joy in their friends and joy in a variety of other passions. And I'm not saying she had none of that. But in the end, she was a person who measured herself by how much she'd accomplished. When Dewey became not the special prosecutor but the regular New York DA, he appointed Eunice head of what was called the Bureau of Special Sessions, which was the largest bureau in the prosecutor's office. She had, as the black newspapers gleefully liked to report, she had 71 white lawyers reporting to her. And I think she was happy. I think this had her delighted. I think when she was out in San Francisco at the meeting about the founding of the United Nations, I think that she was happy. I think when she was traveling overseas in the 50s and early 60s to give speeches in Greece and in Switzerland and in London and a variety of other places, I think she was happy. I think she was happiest when she was feeling she was accomplishing something. She was moving forward. She was making her mark in the world. I don't say she took no joy from anything else, but I think that's what made her happiest.
Stephen, we talked earlier about how few African-American families know about their histories or how much isn't passed on. Now you and your daughter have deeply mined your family line, found out about your great-grandfather, great-great-grandfather, his determination, the impact they had on the world. Does it give you perspective on your own life?
It does in a number of different ways. The first thing I should say is that it's changed my view of my grandmother. My grandmother, as I said, used to just scare me when I was young. And now I have enormous respect and boundless admiration for what she was able to accomplish at the time that she did. But more than that, when I look at these things that were accomplished against all the odds by people in my family and, of course, by people who weren't in the family, it gives me a sense of real optimism about the future. I know so many people are pessimistic these days. They don't know what's going to happen in the future. But when we look at these stories in the past, we realize how much can be accomplished against much greater odds than people are facing today. It's a reminder that we should be optimistic. We should be upbeat. We should believe that in the long run that hard work and determination and fortitude really will carry us forward.
Well, I'm going to hold on to that message today, Stephen Carter. As I say, thank you so much for your time and just an incredible story.
Well, thank you very much.
That is best-selling novelist and Yale Law professor Stephen Carter. His most recent book is called Invisible, The Forgotten Story of the Black Woman Lawyer Who Took Down America's Most Powerful Mobster. That is it for today. On Second Thought is produced by Amelia Brock, Leighton Rowell, and The Raven Taylor. Jesse Neiswanger is our engineer. Don Smith, our dean of grammar. Amy Kiley is senior producer. And Sarah Shariari is managing editor for GPB News. We invite your comments, questions, and civil complaints at our Facebook group, GPB Radio On Second Thought. We're on Twitter at OST Talk. You can email us at onsecondthought@gpb.org or leave us a message at 404-500-9457. I'm Virginia Prescott on Facebook at Virginia Prescott GPB, which could frankly really use some love. We're here Monday through Friday at 9 or anytime when you subscribe to our podcast. Hit the programs tab for On Second Thought at gpbnews.org to subscribe. And in the background, the unmistakable voice of Paul Robeson, who was a friend of Alpheus Hunton, and their friendship is detailed in the book.
If a starry sky's ablaze with light, and in your heart love's tender words I'll hide, I'll walk beside you through.